Hi, I'm Suzanne Marnaka. Stories of Change. Summers in the Michigan countryside in the 1950s as a child were pleasant. There were no other children nearby, so I spent countless hours outside with my dogs or riding my old wooden skateboard on the sidewalks of the county farm. The county farm was also known as the Poor Farm. It was a large institution where both my grandma and my mom had worked for years, cleaning and working in the kitchen, or finally in the main office. My mom would dress up each morning in her black suit and high heels and walk across our country road to work. It was a casual workplace, and I was welcome to come over and help as I could. The people who lived there were referred to as inmates. They were homeless, elderly, without family support, and/or physically and mentally ill, and had lived their entire lives in our little farming community. I saw them as my friends and playmates. Usually I would go hang out with them during their activities, making rag rugs from old torn clothing, in the wood shop where the men made furniture, in the kitchen where I could help set tables or fetch food from huge walk-in refrigerators, or my favorite, going to the barn to collect eggs. The point I want to make here is these people, these inmates, as they were known, were interesting, loving human beings. They had wonderful stories to share and all worked as they could to contribute to the well-being of others. If they could cook or clean or tear rags or make furniture or raise chickens, that is how they contributed. That was their payment for living in the county farm. But it also was their purpose. They had all been raised in our community, so everyone from a young age worked on the farm as they were able. When I began spending time at the county home, I was quite young, so I never realized that the residents had lived through, many of them, through the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. They had lost countless family members and friends, and yet they welcomed this kid into their county home. In the later 1960s, laws were passed so that people living in these institutions could not be expected to work without pay. Suddenly, no one could work communally because there was no money to pay them. I now understand why these laws were passed. Some other institutions abused people who lived there and made profit from their work. My experience as a child was heavily influenced by my own feelings and the opinions of my mother and grandmother. They believed the county home was a good place where these local individuals found purpose in their jobs. The law that was passed had good intentions, but also unexpected and adverse consequences. Individuals who had felt valued and part of the larger community were not allowed to contribute as they had before. No one could help in the kitchen or work in the barn. My mother complained to me that these people now had to be medicated because of boredom and lack of purpose. Eventually, professional activity directors were hired, and the residents, formerly called inmates, became engaged in meaningful ways that allowed them to remain involved. Times changed and everyone adapted to the new world. These loving residents of the county home taught me very important life lessons about never wasting anything or you would go without. They taught me the importance of kindness and patience and the importance of hard work. They taught me that love and listening is always the best approach in all of life's challenges. These are all lessons we can take forward as we adapt, change, and survive in this current pandemic. waste nothing, do hard work, show love and deep kindness, and may it be so.
As the time of the pandemic now has its own unknown span, there emerges a sense of ongoing chaos. We are in the midst of moral dilemmas that are no longer academic and command increasing anxiety and rage as people rebel against the needs for social distancing, isolation, and economic shutdowns. The very measures necessary to contain the COVID-19 virus are denigrated by some as infringements upon personal freedoms and rights. Now, this is not a reaction unique to COVID and our current times. And what has worked or not worked in prior pandemics still has lessons for today. There are powerful implications during this pandemic concerning how we must look after our communities and our neighbors, but also how anxiety and political polarization may create greater damage and uncertainty. It is already difficult to endure social isolation and distancing, yet it is another source of distress to recognize the risks arising from community members who are in denial of risk and thereby endanger others, even those to whom they are most close. The experiences of the 1918 and 19 flu pandemic are remarkably parallel to what we are going through now. Many perceived the flu of that era as overblown, just a big scare. Professional baseball and football were halted in October of 1918. And then masks became a scapegoat, a symbol of government overreach. There were scuffles in response to mandatory mask wearing being seen as a threat to freedom and liberty. The rise of groups such as the Anti-Mask League and masks being characterized as mere dirt and dust traps doing more harm than good. Penalties for violators of mandatory mask laws then could be as great as 10 days imprisonment, with 1,000 arrests in one day in November 1918 in San Francisco. Masks and other mandated interventions resulted in a bomb threat to a health officer and an armed altercation between a health inspector and an anti-master. As with today's issues, a main concern were the financial impacts of social distancing and the mandatory closures of businesses. As we might be seeing in late summer of 2020, there was a second wave of flu in late 1918 that caused a reinstitution of mask ordinances in 1919. Well, looking back at these controversial measures, what does history and the current research say about the effectiveness of sometimes controversial behavioral interventions, then and now? An exhaustive study in 2007 of community health archives during the flu pandemic found a strong association between early, sustained, and combined applications of behavioral interventions, resulting in the mitigation of the consequences of the influenza pandemic. School closures and public gathering bans were the most common interventions in 1918, and communities with earlier interventions experienced lower flu mortalities. 100 years later, research on COVID-19 published just last month found strong evidence that school closures decrease COVID cases and deaths, with the greatest beneficial impacts having occurred with earlier closings when COVID prevalence was still low. The question remains as to whether we will neglect current and historical guidance and whether we may, as a society, precipitate more severe waves of illness in the near future. Behavioral interventions to reduce the transmission of the virus may reduce COVID death rates, but COVID-related social and emotional risk factors such as unemployment, late-life depression, social isolation, and lack of community are all associated with increases in mortality from COVID and other causes. COVID research has found elevated rates of COVID among nursing home residents, the imprisoned, and the disabled or disadvantaged, all groups of persons already at higher risk of social and emotional damages to health. A very timely research article in February reviewed assessments of the psychological impact of quarantine and not surprisingly noted increases in anger, confusion, and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, symptoms, similar to adverse mental health impacts on the overall UK population during early months of COVID in Britain. The final sentence of that article about quarantine was a succinct and well-targeted recommendation. Appeals to altruism by reminding the public about the benefit of quarantine to wider society can be favorable. The impacts of COVID across the family lifespan are still poorly understood. There has been discussion of how COVID illness may increase adversity for families and children, as well as how older family members are more vulnerable to severe COVID symptoms. However, there is also recent growing concern about problems within what is being called the lockdown generation, those youth and young adults whose transitions through high school into college and professional preparation and then careers will be frozen, whether due to no athletic scholarships or seasons or no clinical training or no part-time temp work to fund education and newly launched families. This is an emerging international concern, and the UN Secretary General just this past week raised a warning of a potential generational catastrophe in education worldwide. Suzanne and I have seen a granddaughter with social and emotional regression after months without the support of much valued teachers and friends. We know firsthand the limits to virtual teaching. We have decades of experience with the power of academic mentoring and the deep impacts of small group participatory learning experiences. And just this month, the American Medical Association documented extreme nationwide concerns about dramatic increases in opioid-related overdoses during COVID. Even as COVID has taken apart our social and economic and educational fabric, we are confronted with other epidemics such as addiction and are facing racial wounds to our culture and our communities, which have not healed even after centuries of pain and are even more evident during this pandemic. Those youth who will grow up in the shadow and under the restrictions of COVID are not the first generation to have dealt with pervasive limitations. After the flu pandemic, the next decade brought the Great Depression's economic collapse, ongoing challenges of tuberculosis, the Dust Bowl, and little economic recovery until World War II. A social intervention in the 1930s, which continues to give us significant returns even today, was the New Deal and its programs to address social needs and to rebuild infrastructure, even while providing employment and education for those in need. We need to reacquaint ourselves with that generation's efforts and how to emulate such programs. Previous times and voices understand how this pandemic creates a tension between individuality and the social good. We must appreciate historical and prophetic voices as guides for how we must confront racial and socioeconomic injustices, along with the growing threats of homelessness and limited access to health care brought into focus by COVID. Well, our Unitarian Universalist faith traditions speak about spiritual and social survival in such times as we are experiencing. We cannot attend spiritual services with live contact with others, but we can maintain our own roots and find connections even when doors and communities are closed. Our Unitarian Universalist traditions urge us onward through the use of history and science, the affirmation of compassion and community, and the openness to visions and revisions of what we will uphold after this pandemic era ends. For now, we are called to live more richly in the moment while appreciating the emotional storms, the damages wrought by illness, and the deep roots of faith, science, and hope despite our vulnerabilities today. Well, may there be singing, stories, humor, tears, and eventually, maybe perhaps, hugs. You probably remember them. Stay centered, value the earth, reach out across generations, take guidance from daily miracles, stay on the trail. There will be the eventual restoration of small businesses, community resources, social events, successful life transitions, and a social climate with greater safety and ease for all. But it's up to us to learn good and healing lessons from this trying time. Meanwhile, at least for us, harvest your gardens, prepare for the next season, anticipate springtime, rediscover teachers and prophets, protect the environment, advocate for the vulnerable, revive social connections, even if only by computer or letter or gift. Reach out, appreciate, affirm, and do it again. Oh, and don't forget, there's only one way out of this hole. Let's go. Thank you.